Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Adolescence is a prime time to try on risky behaviors. That's especially true for young people living in a stressful environment. This is Colleen Shaddix for the Yale Office of Public Affairs, talking with Dr. Linda Mays about research designed to find out what's happening inside teenagers' heads and how adults might help them make better decisions. When I say you're looking at what's happening inside teenagers' heads, I mean that literally. You've done a lot of work on brain development that goes on during adolescence, and also you're using really interesting imaging technology to get a beat on that. Can you give us a little intro to that and talk about the connection between that work and addiction?
Sure, and it's a pleasure to be here to do that. So, Colleen, one of the interesting developmental issues in adolescence is that we have been granted a wonderful time in our development of our brains where things are rapidly changing when children are 12 to 15, 16. Every parent knows that. Mm-hmm. Every parent knows that and can say that in different language. But the front part of the brain where adolescents make decisions, the prefrontal cortex, with a tremendous amount of what we call in our field executive control function, where you decide, is this right or wrong? Should I act on this now or later? Do I remember the consequences from before? How do I make judgments? Mm-hmm. During that time, during that particular time of adolescence, that area of the brain is in rapid change, Probably one of the most rapid, save for early childhood, toddlerhood, the other most rapid time of brain change in our overall human development. Coupled with that, however, is the fact that adolescents are what we call the subcortical parts of their brain, where they're very sensitive to reward. That is probably at the highest activity ever in development as well. And what I mean by that is that adolescents will try things just for the sheer sometimes pleasure, for the sheer sort of emotional jolt of the reward that they might get. Driving fast, perhaps trying that drug, taking a chance, going to stand on a cliff with your friends, and all of that has a basic developmental biology, that is their exquisite sensitivity to reward, which is, as I say, the highest ever across development. But at the same time, here's the catch-22, an exquisite sensitivity to reward, but the part of their brain where they are making decisions, appraising consequences, is not as mature.
So it's a double whammy.
In a way, it's a double whammy. It's a, what we might call a developmental imbalance between the great time where no other time in our life are we probably most interested in trying something new, new chances. But at the same time, no other time in our life is there this great imbalance between that and our capacity to think about the consequences of that decision, as in the prefrontal cortex. So where does that come out to be a risk for drug abuse? Drugs are extremely rewarding. Drugs really stimulate heavily that area of the brain, the dopaminergic circuits that are involved in reward. So that's a time. That's a time when adolescents might be very sensitive to that, but they're unable to judge the consequences potentially of that trying that particular drug, trying marijuana, smoking cigarettes, trying more serious drugs. Where social science comes in then is understanding that developmental imbalance period, that sensitive period, if you will, then the social context of the adolescent's world makes a huge difference.
So we've got this sort of organic danger spot going on.
Biological vulnerability period, yes.
What happens when you throw stress into that mix?
So when you throw stress into that mix, this is actually work that a lot of this work has gone on at Yale, and that's why the new stress consortium is so important, because it brings investigators from all over. But Amy Arnston has for years at Yale been studying the impact of stress, or what we might call excessive emotional arousal, on prefrontal cortex. So in moments of high stress, all of us, every one of us, it's granted to us by our normal biology. At moments of high stress, we essentially turn down our prefrontal cortex and turn up those areas of the brain that we need for automatic, quick acting. So an example that I often use, which I think makes perhaps sense to adults, is if you're standing on the busy street corner in New Haven and you're about to cross the street and you hear the screeching of tires, you don't use that part of your brain at that moment to appraise whether it's a Ford, a Chevrolet, mm-hmm. is it a blue car or a red car, a large car or a small car coming towards you, you automatically jump back. And for a little bit of time after that frightening moment, you'll be very aware that you're distracted. You're not really focusing on what you were focusing on before the car came towards you. In Dr. Arnston's language, you've turned down, you've down-regulated your prefrontal cortex and up-regulated those older parts of our brain that we need for automatic responding. So if you're a stressed adolescent, what we might say is in this still this period where your prefrontal cortex is developed, you have what you called referred to earlier, a true double whammy. Mm-hmm. And that is you have an increased sensitivity to stress, which down-regulates further your prefrontal cortex. And also, you may use rewarding things such as drugs, driving fast, early sex. You may use those things to increase your reward, your sense of reward and pleasure, which also diminishes your kind of negative emotional tension, that is your stress. So there's two things going on at the same time.
So stress would sort of steer people toward experimentation that we're not thrilled about.
That actually comes interestingly out of Rajita Sinha's work, Rajita being, you know, the director of the Stress Consortium. That comes out of her long work with her colleagues on the relationship between stress and addiction, that many people use drugs as a way of what you might say down-regulating your stress. We all know it in more common language. You come mm-hmm. home after a terribly stressful day. You may, if you like wine, you may turn to a glass of wine. If exercise is what is your rewarding thing, you run a little longer that day, or you call your best friend, or you put on your old sweater. You do something that's rewarding, that decreases your kind of negative emotional state. We all do it. But in individuals that are susceptible to addiction, that relationship between stress and drug use may be exquisitely sensitive.
And where is the crossover between experimentation and addiction?
Uh-huh.
Between a kid sort of, you know, taking a wrong path for a few steps and staying on that path?
That's a really, really important question, and it's a question that all of us are extremely interested in. So there's been a lot of speculation about that, running from intergenerational, you do what your parents do, you do what your peers do. So if you're, you know, if all your peers are using drugs and you're experimenting, you're more likely to use more and thus become more likely to be addicted. To then the more kind of general sort of gateway theories that once you use at a certain vulnerable period in your life, then you're on a path to addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we would all say right now is the mechanisms aren't entirely clear. But they're much more likely to be an interaction between genetic risk, that you bring a certain genetic vulnerability to the rewarding, stimulating properties of drugs, coupled with environmental risk, that your social world is more, you have drugs more available to you, and you don't have access to potentially other more rewarding things. And probably then the overall cultural world in which you live, that values or that provides you a structure that's different from going to drugs. So if your cultural world says, no, experimentation's okay, you know, mm-hmm. what harm could come from it, and you have that genetic vulnerability and that stress sensitivity, then you're more likely potentially to go to the addictive pathway versus stopping at experimentation.
So if we can identify these risk factors, what can we do to better support kids?
Oh. So many things. So many things. So in my own lab, we have been for now almost 16 years studying the longitudinal impacts, for example, of prenatal cocaine exposure. And this will sound as a roundabout way to answering your question. But so we can say, for example, that prenatal exposure to stimulants such as cocaine probably has some very direct effects on brain. On the other hand, what we can also say is that our control group are kids growing up in New Haven who are also growing up in tremendous economic adversity and economic disadvantage. And in many ways, while our kids exposed to drugs prenatally are doing poorly on some areas, our control groups are doing actually just as poorly on some of the areas. And that is the tremendous social effect of poverty. And and not intervening early, not providing kids and their parents enough opportunities early on. There are a number of studies now. It's a wealth of studies out there about the early and long-term impact of economic deprivation, probably through several mechanisms. One is that if your parents are struggling day to day to figure out where the rent's going to come, where the food's going to come, are they going to keep their job? They are stressed. And we also know that when parents are stressed, their kids are stressed. And early stress has an enduring impact on these stress regulatory mechanisms that we're talking about then conveying a risk in adolescence for experimentation with drugs.
Well, it's interesting, though, but when you talk about drug prevention, the common method is to do something in middle school, high school.
Right. Well, remember, I'm a developmentalist. I'm someone who works with kids from infancy all the way through. And I would never say that one period is more than another, more important mm-hmm. than another. But I would say that intervening early and intervening in parent-child and the parent-child sort of family relationships probably has an extraordinary impact on adolescent risk for substance use. We don't usually think that way, because you're right. Absolutely right. We usually think of, let's stop the source. Let's go, drugs are in middle school, kids are using in middle school, that's where we start. And obviously, you don't start early and not address what's going on down later. But I need to take one step back to say that there's also, in this kind of complex world of developmental systems, there's also a tremendously rapidly emerging body of work on how early parenting impacts stress regulatory systems. And this is coming from a lot of the preclinical, from animal models. Mm-hmm. Michael Meaney's work in Canada is one example that many, many people cite of how just individual variations in early parenting conveys these enduring impacts on how animals as adults respond to stress. More depriving, more neglectful parenting leads to, in adulthood, greater permeability to stress.
So it's hard to really overestimate how important those first few years are.
Absolutely, absolutely. And not only the first few years, I mean, parenting has its impact or care throughout. And there clearly are periods, sensitive periods throughout development. But there are a number of us who actually believe, strange as it might sound, that interventions in toddlerhood and preschool, if properly directed, hypothesis-driven toward these mechanisms, that is stress sensitivity, impulse behavior, how one responds to, you know, negative emotions, that interventions directed in early childhood toward those specific kinds of functions will have actually an impact on adolescent substance use through this stress regulatory mechanism.
Now, I want to go back to something you said earlier, that you've been studying this cohort for 16 years.
Yes.
How unusual is that, to stick with study volunteers that long? And how does that inform your work?
Well, there are a number across the country. There are a number of groups that have been studying this. I think there are five or six cohorts or groups that of children who've been followed longitudinally. Ours is one of the oldest, but not the oldest. We have a colleague, for example, in Canada, Peter Fried, who studied marijuana exposure in pregnancy, and his children are now young adults with children themselves. So it does happen. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, what to say is, first off, it's a privilege for families to let us be in their lives for so long. It's a very, very special privilege. It also takes a lot of work to be sure that we are sensitive to them, that be sure that we stay in touch with them. So it takes a lot of tracking and those efforts. And then the third thing to say is that probably the longitudinal perspective, being involved in a child or an adult's life over time, gives you a window on change that's very different from just taking samples of adults or children at one point, then seeing another group at another age, what we call cross-sectional. Mm-hmm. And the reason is this. why longitudinal perspectives are so different and important. Think of ourselves. Just put it in your own perspective. While we're all told, you know, that this stage of development follows the previous stage, that middle age is like this and old age is like this and adolescence is like this, you know. You know from your own development that you shifted in and out. Some things came a little earlier. Some things came a little later. Maybe you started working when you were 14. You know, maybe you delayed college till you were 30. That development doesn't move in these kinds of average, predictable paths. That we all move in and out of sometimes normative adaptations, sometimes not normative. When you follow individuals over time, you can see those individual trajectories. And doing things like we have a method called growth curve analysis, which allows us to track each individual's trajectory and then average it, of course, as a group. But also we see the kind of individual variation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you can get from longitudinal perspectives. The other thing you can get from longitudinal perspectives is what predicts to what. So, for example, one of the questions most interesting in us right now, and we have more data in this longitudinal study than we'll ever,
I'll bet.
ever. We need an army of people to write about it. Is if you're an impulsive, highly stressed toddler, and we have ways of looking at that, are you going to be one of these highly stressed adolescents?
Do you have an answer yet?
We have a probability, and the probability is more likely. But from a developmentalist point of view, the answer is not 100%. Mm-hmm. And so the really interesting question then becomes, if you've got that risk factor at age 3, we can either say, what predicts to your likelihood to be that drug-using adolescent? But the other question is, what protects you?
Right.
So if it were 100% from age 3 there, it'd be interesting. But it wouldn't in some ways be nearly as interesting as this kind of divergence, because the divergence suggests that there are intervention points. What could we do? And one of the things that we would say might be protective are good someone in your life that is a strong social attachment figure. Can be a teacher, can be a coach, can be your next door neighbor. Could be your grandfather. It doesn't have to be your parents. Mm-hmm. Obviously, can be your parents too, but those are among some of the protective factors.
Let's. I'm putting myself in the shoes of parents listening to this.
Oh yeah, please.
And hearing about the risky time and the pleasure seeking, the adventurousness. That's a good thing too.
Yes. Right.
Because we want them to be more independent at that
Absolutely.
Age. We want them to explore what they want to do for a career.
Absolutely.
So how do you encourage good risk taking while discouraging bad risk taking?
Well that's in some ways, if there were a Nobel Prize for social science, that's the Nobel Prize question. But it brings up two really important points. And one is that when we as social scientists, as clinicians, talk about risk-taking, you're right that we usually have in our mind the negative side. We're always talking about, you know, driving too fast, drug experimentation. But you're absolutely right that probably why, if you want to take an evolutionary perspective on development, one might ask, why have we been given this prolonged adolescence that has this apparent developmental imbalance and risk-taking or reward-seeking and a consequence appraisal? Why? Well, one reason you could argue, and evolutionary perspectives are always kind of just so stories, but one reason you could argue is that in the best of circumstances, that's the time in your development when you're most open to new possibilities, to taking, as you say, chances, positive chances.
Otherwise, why leave mom and dad's cave?
Exactly. Why leave their cave? Why just do what they did, do what's safe? And for our culture, for our society, for humans to move ahead, we need to take chances. And so all of us, I think, in this world need to struggle with the question of what's positive risk-taking. What makes that CEO that's willing to invest all in that idea that everyone's saying it'll never work? What makes that person? Don't have the answer, but we have hints. And one of the hints, for example, for parents, comes from a colleague who used to be at Yale, Sunya Luthar, who has been looking at adolescents from a range of economic circumstances and asking a number of questions about their risk-taking, their development. And one aspect of her work really stands out. She asks the adolescent, who has you in mind when you come home from school, among a number of questions.
Mm-hmm.
But just that one as an example. Adolescents who say basically, no one. No one knows that really where, or, you know, they don't really know where I am. They're more likely to be experimenting with drugs, more likely to be depressed, and perhaps if girls have eating problems as adolescents. So what can we extract from that? It's not so much a burden for parents, but that parents have a very important role, even though adolescence is a stormy time,
mm-hmm.
a very important role in their adolescence life in the very simple to say, harder to do, act of holding your adolescent in mind.
Even if they're pushing you away.
Even if they're pushing you away. Even if they're pushing you away. It doesn't mean be an adolescent yourself and try to learn about all the, you know, the contemporary music, but conveying in various ways that you not only want to know where they are, but you care about where they are. You care about what they're thinking. You care about the fact that you know that everyone around them might be using marijuana and they're struggling with that decision. It's not necessarily to say do or don't, but that you care about that struggle. Now, like I say, that's so much more simple to say than do, but it conveys what we know is developmentally important across all ages for parents to hold their children in mind. Now, we've switched, you know, from talking about dopamine and brain cells to talking about psychology and mental states, but there's a dialectic
connection
between those.
Thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Linda Mays of Yale's Stress, Self-Control, and Addiction Consortium and the Yale Child Study Center about adolescence and risky behavior. For more information, please visit yalestress.org.